exercise. I'm gonna have this figured out sooner or later. I was just saying to Charlotte, I don't think I learned anything about eccentric versus concentric 30-some years ago, but they must have identified it by then. Anyway. We did know about muscles, anyway. We had to, right? And I used to know all their origins and insertions, even. So the title of this next presentation is Effects of Eccentric versus Concentric Exercise in Stimulating Muscle Hypertrophy, Strength Gains, and Enhanced Performance. And the supervisor is Dr. Darlene Reed, who I don't see, unfortunately. She's what? Hoping to make it. Okay. I'm right on time. And the presenters are Greg, Bob, Patrick, Ryan, and Sarah. Such nice, easy names. I think I got them all right. Take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Susan. And thanks, everybody, for coming today and coming back from the break. I know it's sunny outside, but it's like the sun is shining in here, looking at all your beautiful faces. So, I'm Greg. I'm going to be covering the introduction, and then Ryan is going to be covering the methods. Patrick, Sarah, and myself are going to discuss the results, and then Bob is going to wrap it up as we go through the conclusion. So I only ask two things of you today, and that is no flash photography, please, as it distracts us, and our egos are already quite large. And two, buckle up as I take you on this journey of effects of eccentric versus concentric exercise and stimulating gains in strength, hypertrophy, and performance in healthy adults. Okay, so resistance training is used by many areas of the population. We use it for athletic performance, for rehabbing from injuries, trying to prevent injuries, or just trying to maintain a healthy lifestyle. So as you can see, it relates to all of us personally because we prescribe it and it can be applied to a lot of the population. So inherent in resistance exercise is two types of muscle actions. You have concentric and eccentric. So what we did, we wanted to define these as we used them in our study. So we defined an eccentric contraction as a dynamic muscle action, which occurs when external resistance exceeds muscle force and the muscle lengthens while developing tension. And we defined concentric as a dynamic muscle action, which occurs when muscle shortens and joint movement occurs as the tension develops. Okay, so whenever we talk about eccentric and concentric in here, we're talking about just that contraction, just pure in itself, not combined movements. So, research has looked at the difference between pure eccentric and concentric contractions and has come up with different physiological differences. So some of these are an increased ability to produce greater amounts of tension. So eccentric contractions, you can produce more tension. So if you lift, say, 100 pounds concentrically, you can probably lower about 120. Eccentric contractions have decreased amount of oxygen and ATP consumption for a comparable workload, so they're a bit more metabolically efficient. Decreased EMG activation, so you have a recruitment of a smaller motor unit pool for a given tension. For a concentric, you know, Henneman's size principle, you recruit the smaller fibers first and the larger ones. For eccentric, it's usually a bit different. You use the bigger fibers and use a smaller motor unit pool. And there's also smaller decreases in strength following repeated muscle contractions, so there's less fatigue with eccentric contractions. There's greater cross-education. So what this is, if you're training, say, your left tricep, then you're going to get strength increases on your right tricep. And this cross effect is greater when you're training eccentrically than concentrically. And you also can get, with eccentric contractions, an increased muscle damage and DOMS as well. So our rationale for this, looking at all these physiological differences, we saw some potential benefits that could be used using eccentric contractions. So we have the potential for development of greater strength gains because you can overload the muscle to a greater extent. And this obviously would have some implications for athletic performance, for prevention of injuries through strengthening muscle imbalances. And obviously strength is used as a primary outcome measure in the rehab setting. And we also looked, you could probably get superior adaptations in muscular conditioning because the metabolic efficiency is much greater. So the main premise is this, is someone could get equal or maybe even greater strength gains using eccentric contractions, yet at a lower metabolic cost. So this would have implications for older adults or some clinical populations that have a decreased energy capacity, such as MS. So from this, we posed our review question, which is eccentric training superior to concentric training in stimulating gains in muscular strength, hypertrophy, and performance in healthy adults? So now Ryan will come and discuss the methods for you.
Okay, so I'm just going to talk about the methods, and basically I just going to give you guys a little insight in how we came to finally get to our final selected articles that we're reviewing for you today. So let's start out with the inclusion criteria. So basically, studies were included if they looked at healthy adult subjects, which we defined as subjects being 18 to 65 years. Also, studies had to have a resistance training program of at least 4 weeks in duration with a minimum of 2 times a week. And also, the participants had to be tested and trained on an isokinetic dynamometer. We chose this as an inclusion criteria based on the fact that the isokinetic dynamometer has been proven in the past to be a standardized tool which produces reliable results. So it makes this easier to compare data on our topic. Another inclusion criteria was that studies had to compare eccentric and concentric training in the study, and they had to measure at least one of the following outcome measures, which was presented in our research question, that being strength, hypertrophy, or performance. And finally, they had to have either a randomized control trial or a clinical control trial. So exclusion criteria. Studies were excluded from our review if participants had any existing or known pathologies. In addition to this, if they only looked at one comparison, so if a study just looked at eccentric training, or if it just looked at concentric training, it wasn't included, it actually had to look at the comparison of eccentric and concentric training. And in addition to this, crossover studies with an insufficient washout period were also excluded from the study. That was defined as less than 6 months. And non-English studies were also excluded. Okay, so now I'm just going to kind of go through what our search strategy looked like. It was a pretty comprehensive search strategy, I would say. And it started with the electronic search, which was based on many key terms and mesh words, thanks to Charlotte. Thank you very much. And basically what we did is we had this electronic search based on this strategy. We put it through these databases that are listed here. So the Sports Discus, Embase, Medline, Cinel, Pedro, and the Cochrane Control Trial Register. We also did gray literature searches, which were conducted through ProQuest, Papers First, and Proceedings First. And in addition to this, hand searches were also performed in the following listed journals up there. Each of us chose a journal that we thought was appropriate for our topic, and we did it in April 2007 and went back 10 years from there. So we went back to January 1997. In addition to this, reference lists of included studies were screened using the same criteria as applied for the initial citations. Okay, so this is just kind of an idea of our study selection, kind of a little flow chart here. Basically, there's three major steps which everybody had was getting the citations, which was based on our search strategy, then breaking it down to the abstract level, and then finally to the full text articles, which were made the decision for inclusion in our final decisions to make the full text. So in each level, it was kind of like the same process where two independent reviewers would review at each level to make the decision is if it would move on to the next level. So first, that we based on our search strategy, we had 1,933 potential relevant publications. And basically, these were all included onto the abstract level if they showed any potential relevance to our review. Beyond that, at the abstract level, it was a little different at the abstract and the full text level, where there was actually a standardized screening tool that was developed, where the two reviewers would also use the standardized screening tool, come together and make a consensus on which would be included into the final review. So it ended up being 11 full text articles, and at the full-text screening level, 22 of them were excluded for reasons related to our inclusion and exclusion criteria. So methods, so now we'll just talk quickly about the quality and evidence assessment. So our quality assessment, we had a few different tools that we used for different reasons. One was created was the modified Van Tueller scale, which looked at the methodological quality of each individual study. And it's modified because it's actually the last question was deemed inappropriate for our study and replaced by the first question of the Pedro scale, which was related to the eligibility criteria. So that was the 11-point scale. Then we also had the Sackett's model, which was used to describe the level of evidence for each individual study. And that was also based on the individual study design as well as the study quality. And that will be described a little bit further in detail in a little bit by Sarah. Finally, we had the best evidence synthesis tool that was basically used to describe the overall grade of evidence. So when compiling things based on different outcome measures and making different comparisons, that was used. And it ranged from, you could either have strong evidence all the way down to no evidence for a particular outcome measure. Decisions for the ranking order or overall grade of this evidence was based on the individual study design as well as the quality. And in addition to this, they looked at the number of studies that show significant findings for a particular outcome measure. And that was actually provided to us from the tendinopathy group as well as Linda Lee. So we thank you guys for that. Data extraction was basically, we formed a standardized data extraction form, which was basically developed to help standardize the data extraction and ease the extraction process. Again, this was done by two independent reviewers, and consensus was met at the end. And finally, data analysis. Basically, what we did was we decided to have three major qualitative comparisons that were based on our research question as well as our outcome measures. And they read, the first comparison we'll talk about is the effectiveness of eccentric versus concentric training on eccentric, concentric, and isometric strength. The second comparison being the effectiveness of eccentric versus concentric training on selected hypertrophy measures. And the final comparison being the effectiveness of eccentric versus concentric training on selected performance measures. Now Sarah's going to come up and talk to you guys a little bit about the results.
So I'd like to start just by orienting you to this table that includes the quality score, the study design, and the level of evidence for all 11 studies included in our review. So starting with the quality score, as Ryan mentioned, based on that modified Van Tueller scale, a maximum possible score of 11. The scores ranged from a low of 3 to a high score of 7. We further subdivided the groups based on that quality score into either high or low studies. High studies were defined to be those that received a quality score of greater than or equal to 5 out of 11 on that modified Van Tueller scale, low scales being those that received a score of 4 or less. Moving to the study design, as per our inclusion criteria, all studies were either RCTs or CCTs. We had 7 randomized controlled trials and 4 CCTs in our study. And finally, the level of evidence, all studies, again, either 1B or 2B levels based on Sackett's model. Starting with a description of the participants, a little bit of variety here. 8 of the studies looked at untrained participants. 1 study looked at moderately trained individuals. And finally, 2 studies looked at highly trained tennis players. 3 studies looked at female-only subjects, 5 studies looking at male-only subjects, and 3 studies looked at male and female subjects. The age of the participants was quite homogeneous, with a lot of the studies using that typical population of university or college age individuals. And so the mean age was 24 years, and the range was 19.6 years to 33 years. Dropout rate was described by 7 of the studies, with a mean of 1.4 subjects dropping out, and the range was 0 to 6 subjects. The training intervention was highly variable between the 11 studies. 7 of the studies looked at knee extension exercise. 1 looked at knee flexion and extension exercise. 2 looked at shoulder internal and external rotation. And 1 final study looked at elbow flexion exercise. The frequency of training ranged from 2 to 4 days per week. So our inclusion criteria required a minimum of 2 days. The duration of the study ranged from 4 to 20 weeks, although the majority of the studies were in the 6 to 10 week range. The volume again was highly variable. The total number of exercise sessions ranging from 12 to 60, and also the number of sets and reps was variable, with as low as 6 contractions to as many as 72 contractions completed in a single exercise session. 8 of the studies used maximal intensity, so an absolute intensity, where both eccentric and concentric training groups trained at maximal levels. And 2 of the studies used relative load. So the eccentric training group exercised at the same relative loads to the concentric training group. And one study used a submaximal intensity. Unfortunately, they didn't specify further what this was. 3 of the studies included used a periodized design, and the remaining 8 maintained a constant number of sets and reps throughout the duration of the study. And finally, the contraction speed was also variable from 60 to 210 degrees per second. And 9 of the studies used a single speed for all contractions, and 2 studies used a pyramidal scheme of contraction speeds. And Pat's going to begin discussing the strength results.
Okay, we can all just admire this photo here. Someone we all might know who asked to be left anonymous. So to preserve continuity, we've decided to present the results and discussion in each of our selected individual subtopics together. So I will begin by presenting sort of the results and the discussion portion of strength, and then we will progress to hypertrophy and performance. So here are the results for the effectiveness of eccentric and concentric training on eccentric, concentric, and isometric strength. So for eccentric strength, 10 out of 11 of our studies measured eccentric strength in both the eccentric training group and the concentric training group. 9 out of 10 of these studies found significant increases with eccentric training, and 8 out of 10 of the studies found significant increases with concentric training. And I should mention that the other 2 studies out of those 10 found significant or non-significant increases ranging from 13 to 17%. 7 studies compared the significance of eccentric training and concentric training in producing gains in eccentric strength, and all 7 found that eccentric training improved eccentric strength significantly more than concentric training. For concentric strength, again, 10 of 11 studies measured this comparison between the eccentric training group and the concentric training group. 6 out of 10 studies found significant increases with eccentric training, and 9 out of 10 studies found significant increases with concentric training. And again, all of the remaining studies of the 10 found non-significant increases, ranging anywhere from 7 to 16%. Of the 7 studies that compare the significance of eccentric training versus concentric training in producing gains in concentric strength, 2 of 7 found that concentric training improved concentric strength more than eccentric training did. And none of the 7 studies found that eccentric training was significantly more effective. For isometric strength, 4 of 11 studies measured isometric strength in the eccentric training and concentric training groups. 2 of these studies found that isometric strength increased significantly with eccentric training, and 1 study found that isometric strength increased with concentric training. And unfortunately, 2 of the 4 studies did not report whether or not their results were significant. But both of those studies reported increases by both the eccentric training group and the concentric training group. In addition, 3 studies compared the significance of eccentric training and concentric training in producing gains in isometric strength, and mixed results were reported, with one study finding concentric training was superior, 1 study found eccentric training was superior, and 1 study found no significant difference. 2 of the 11 studies went on to calculate total strength by averaging the gains across all contraction types and velocities. And no significant differences were reported in either of these studies between eccentric training and concentric training. So, but three additional studies reported that eccentric training increased eccentric strength significantly more than concentric training increased concentric strength. So now we'll move on to the discussion of the effectiveness of eccentric and concentric training on eccentric, concentric, and isometric strength. Okay, so for eccentric strength, using that best evidence synthesis that Ryan alluded to earlier, we were able to synthesize our results to find an overall grade of evidence based on study quality, methodology, and a total number of studies reporting a significant trend. With respect to eccentric strength, there is strong evidence that both eccentric training and concentric training programs can produce significant gains in eccentric strength. As well, there is strong evidence that eccentric training is superior to concentric training in developing eccentric strength, which suggests that there is a strong mode-specific relationship between eccentric training and eccentric strength development. With respect to concentric strength, there is strong evidence that concentric training and eccentric training programs are both effective in producing gains in concentric strength, and no evidence that concentric training is superior to eccentric training in promoting concentric strength gains. You may recall that two of the seven studies did actually show that concentric training was superior, but based on this best evidence synthesis, this was not conclusive enough to warrant a definitive positive relationship. For isometric strength, we found indicative findings that both eccentric training and concentric training are effective in producing gains in isometric strength, and no evidence that either contraction type was superior to the other. And then for total strength of those two studies, there was no evidence that either contraction type was superior in producing gains in total average strength across all modes and velocities, but strong evidence that eccentric training increased eccentric strength more than concentric training increased concentric strength. And it should mention that of those two studies that recorded total strength, one of those studies didn't report a significant value at all, and the other study was the study that the only study in our group that was measured at a submaximal intensity. So they didn't actually report what intensity they were exercising at, just it was listed as submaximal, which may have been insufficient to show the full potential of strength gains in both contraction types. Okay, so our results clearly show that both eccentric and concentric training are effective methods of inducing strength gains in a healthy adult population. However, eccentric training appears to elicit a more substantial effect on mode specific strengthening. This is based on the fact that all the seven studies that compared eccentric and concentric training showed that eccentric training was superior in promoting eccentric strength, whereas only two of the seven showed that concentric training was superior. And generally, across all comparisons, concentric training tended to not be as mode specific. It was more transferable to other modes and velocities than eccentric training. In addition, eccentric and concentric training appear to be equally effective in producing gains in concentric strength. So because we've had these two distinct outcomes generated by both contraction types, it suggests that different mechanisms are responsible for the increases in strength. And so these mechanisms may result from physiological differences at a contractile level, or perhaps just from sheer differences in force magnitude between the two contraction types. So you recall, maybe from the introduction, eccentric muscle actions have been shown to produce significantly higher force values in the maximal voluntary contraction. So it's possible that the greater increases in strength seen with eccentric strengthening are just due to that you're exercising at a higher absolute load. Two studies address this issue that were in our review by having the eccentric training group and the concentric training group exercises at equal absolute loads. So instead of both groups exercising at their absolute maximum contraction, they set a certain contraction level and both groups had to match it based on looking at a meter which showed how much force they were exerting. There goes the pen. That's okay. Of these two studies, one found that eccentric training was significantly greater at producing gains in eccentric and isometric strength than concentric training, and one found that concentric training was superior to eccentric training in producing gains in isometric strength. and that study didn't actually measure eccentric and concentric strength, so a direct comparison is not possible. So this produces a flip side to the argument, which is that it's possible that a critical relative eccentric load is required to elicit strength gains with eccentric training, and that increases in strength may not be observed unless this critical load is reached. Similar results were observed by a study that was not included in our review because it didn't train on an isokinetic dynamometer, and it found a similar thing, that when the percentage of maximal volume voluntary contraction was too low, that the eccentric gains were not maximized. Okay, I think I got it. So further research is necessary on this topic, but the preliminary results suggest that eccentric training is potentially able to produce significantly greater eccentric gains than concentric training when exercising at equalized loads. So this suggests that there are adaptive mechanisms occurring at the contractile level, which isn't really surprising considering that the two loading types offer a completely different stimulus. With one, you're shortening the sarcomere, and with the other one, you're sort of lengthening and tearing those cross bridges apart, so it's a really distinct stimulus. Though the precise physiological mechanisms behind these adaptations are not within the scope of our review, it's widely agreed that they're due to a combination of neurological factors and hypertrophy. And with that, I will pass you on to Greg, who will enlighten you on hypertrophy.
Okay, so as Pat said, most strength gains can be attributed to neurological or changes in muscle architecture. So changes such as pronation angle or specific tension or hypertrophy is what is underlying the changes in strength. And it's been shown in the literature that hypertrophy has a linear relationship with strength after the initial 8 weeks of training. So that's why we looked at hypertrophy as a physical measure of strength and also as a potential to gain greater strength. So I'm going to discuss the results of the effectiveness of eccentric versus concentric training on the selected hypertrophy measures. So we had 5 out of our 11 studies that included a measure on hypertrophy, 3 of which use a cross-sectional area. So Duncan et al. Reported no significant change in girth for eccentric or concentric training using a thigh circumference measure. Now this study only used a 4-week training protocol, and it's been shown in the literature that you need 6 to 8 weeks before you can usually get measurable changes in hypertrophy. And then a study by Comey et al. Found a significant increase in upper arm circumference in the trained arm of the eccentrically trained group compared to the pretest values of that group and also to the concentrically trained group. And then Higby, using MRI, which is shown to have been the most reliable measure of hypertrophy, showed a significant increase in cross-sectional area in both groups and also a significantly greater increase in the eccentrically trained group compared to the concentrically trained group. Then we had 2 studies that did muscle biopsies looking for changes in fiber type area, because it's thought that obviously changes in hypertrophy are formed from the underlying changes in the fibers, whether it's an increase in number or size. So Hortobaggi showed no significant change in the percentage of type 1 fibers, a significant decrease in type 2B fibers, and a significant increase in type 2A fibers. And they also found that in the eccentrically trained group, there's a 10 times greater increase in the area of type 2A fibers. And the other study that looked at fiber type area was Mayhew. And they showed no significant change in type 1 or type 2 fibers pre-post, but a significant increase in type 2 fiber area in the concentrically trained group compared to eccentrically trained. And this is the study that looked at the absolute load, so they were working at 90% of a concentric value. So because overloading a muscle is what stimulates the protein synthesis, the eccentrically trained group was working at a lower relative maximum voluntary contraction, so the load might not have been great enough to stimulate these gains in hypertrophy. So now as far as the discussion, I'll just let you know what we came to conclusion as far as evidence was showing. And we showed moderate evidence that eccentric muscle training increases skeletal muscle hypertrophy more than concentric training by measure of cross-sectional area. So this was supported by a high-quality RCT and a high-quality CCT. And we also showed moderate evidence that eccentric training increases type 2 fiber area greater than concentric training. And this was supported by a high-quality RCT and a low-quality RCT. And now Sarah will talk to you about performance.
Just in case you're not all confused thoroughly by all the eccentric and concentricness, we've got one more comparison to look at. And that is the effectiveness of eccentric versus concentric training on selected performance measures. So three of the 11 studies included in our review included performance measures. Two of the studies explored the effect of eccentric and concentric training on serve velocity. The participants in both of these studies were trained elite tennis players. Ellen Becker et al. Found that concentric training significantly increased serve velocity compared to pretest values and found no significant change with the eccentric training group. Mont et al. Found that eccentric and concentric training significantly increased serve velocity compared to the control group. The Mont et al. Group also explored percent drop-off of serve velocity and found that both training groups maintained serve velocity better than the control group, but there is no significant difference between eccentric and concentric training. The third study by Miller et al. Included two performance measures. The participants in this study were untrained females. They firstly looked at acceleration time, and that was the time from the start of the repetition until the isokinetic speed was reached. They found that the concentric training group improved acceleration time compared to pretest values for concentric knee extension only. The eccentric training group had significant improvements in acceleration for time for concentric and eccentric movements compared to pretest values. Improvements in acceleration time with acceleration movements, eccentric movements were greater in the eccentric training group compared to the concentric training group. Crystal clear, eh? And then lastly, the time to peak torque was explored. So this is an indication of how quickly the muscle can produce force. Again, they found the concentric training group improved time to peak torque in concentric knee flexion extension only, and the eccentric training group showed significant improvements for concentric and eccentric movements compared to the pretest, and also showed significant improvements in eccentric movements compared to the concentric training group. And then just to finish off with the discussion in regards to these performance measures. In regards to the serve velocity and endurance, again, based on the evidence, best evidence synthesis tool, we found that there was limited evidence that both eccentric and concentric training improves serve velocity. We also found there to be limited evidence that the eccentric and concentric training groups tended to maintain their serve velocity to a significantly greater extent than a control group. And so at this time, it appears that eccentric and concentric training are equally beneficial in improving serve velocity and endurance compared to a training regimen that does not include strength training. So if we look at the tennis serve, for example, it makes sense that concentric training and eccentric training components are going to be important. So concentric training for the forced generation, eccentric training for the controlling of the deceleration of the limb. So the results make sense at this point, but again, not a lot of research. And lastly, the single study that looked at acceleration time as well as time to peak torque. We'll just go through this one. We found indicative findings, again, based on that best evidence synthesis tool. This was the strongest evidence that could be found based on the fact that there was just one study. So there was an indicative finding that concentric training improved acceleration time compared to pretest values for concentric knee extension only. Indicative findings that eccentric training resulted in significant improvements in acceleration time for concentric and eccentric movements compared to the pretest values. For peak time to peak torque, again, indicative findings that concentric training significantly improved time to peak torque in concentric knee flexion and extension, and indicative findings that eccentric training resulted in significant improvements in concentric and eccentric improvements compared to pretest. And these values were also significant compared to the concentric training group. So based on all of that information, and just based on the single study, it appears that The concentric training is more mode specific in this one performance outcome measure, and the eccentric training was more transferable in that it benefited both concentric and eccentric movements. Just to note, this study was completed at 60 degrees per second, so we have to be careful with how we generalize, because a lot of athletic performances and skills are performed at much higher speeds than 60 degrees per second. And Bob's going to wrap it up with some conclusions.
So if you're totally confused, hopefully I can simplify things here with the conclusion. With regards to our first outcome measure, which was strength, we found eccentric and concentric strength training are effective means of producing gains in muscular strength in a population of healthy adults. Also, eccentric training is more effective than concentric strength training in stimulating gains in eccentric strength. And eccentric training increases eccentric strength to a greater degree than concentric training increases concentric strength. With regards to concentric training, there is no evidence to support the superiority of concentric training in stimulating gains in concentric strength. In our second outcome measure, which was hypertrophy, we found eccentric training increases muscle fiber cross-sectional area more than concentric training and induces greater increases in type 2 fiber area. In our third outcome measure, which was performance, we had two studies that looked at serve velocity in tennis players, if you recall, and we found no significant difference in serve velocities between the eccentric training and concentric training groups. One high-quality clinical controlled trial found indicative findings that both eccentric training and concentric training improved acceleration time and concentric time to peak torque. The study also found indicative evidence that eccentric training was more effective at improving eccentric time to peak torque. The role of specificity is highlighted in the findings of our review, particularly for eccentric training. Therefore, a clinician may want to target a specific muscle action to prevent injury of an athlete. An example of this would be to add Nordic hamstring curls to the training program of a sprinter. As we know, sprinters commonly experience hamstring tears during the eccentric swing phase of gait. The findings in our review imply eccentric and concentric training may be used to enhance concentric strength. And yes, training exclusively in one mode may be appropriate under certain circumstances. However, we feel certain caution should be used when interpreting these results, and both modes should be considered when performance and injury prevention is the primary goal. So I guess I forgot to mention this is a clinical implication, so continuing with that. Because eccentric training uses less oxygen and ATP than concentric training at comparable workloads, and because our review showed strong evidence for increases in both concentric strength and eccentric strength with eccentric training, we feel eccentric training with energetically compromised population may be warranted. And now some of the strengths of our review. Our review was limited to randomized controlled trials and clinical controlled trials, as there was a high number of activity articles in this on this topic. With regards to age and health, our studies all had homogeneous populations, which allows for generalizability to the select populations. Also, all training and testing completed was on isokinetic dynamometers, which maintains internal validity by minimizing confounding variables and also allows for more comparability between studies. Now on to the limitations of our study, of our review, that is. We, the reviewers, were not blinded to authors or journal publications. Therefore, study identification bias may have occurred. Also, there were numerous methodological weaknesses within our studies. There were 6 studies of low quality, that being less than 5 on the modified Van Tulder that we used. There were 4 studies that failed to report dropout rates. And there was no allocation, concealment, or assessor blinding in any of our studies. We were also restricted to studies written in English. And aside from 3 articles that looked at performance, the main outcome measures focused on body structure and function level of the ICF, with minimal involvement on an activity and participation level. Also, populations of healthy adults may lack external validity in the clinical population. Finally, the isokinetic dynamometers are not commonly used in clinical rehabilitation due to their high costs, and the isokinetic muscle action forced by these devices is not typical of most functional activities. So now some future recommendations from our review. Some possible reviews that may stem from our review is the comparison of eccentric and concentric training at the same absolute load. Two studies in our review explored this comparison, however, they were unable to be compared due to the different outcome measures they used. Also, differences with fatigue and activation patterns using EMG between eccentric training groups and concentric training groups. Another may be to look at isotonic actions, as this contraction type relates more to the general population. And finally, we feel the examination by examining the effect of the combination of modes versus a single mode is warranted. Some possibilities for future research. We feel more primary research is needed on the effects of resistance training and its application to performance, as this is the most applicable outcome. Lastly, we'd like to make a few acknowledgments. We'd just like to state that the research was not funded by grants or sponsorship, and no relevant conflicts of interest existed for any of the authors. And we'd like to thank Darlene Reed, our supervisor, Angela Bush for her instruction in RSPT 3532, Charlotte Beck for her assistance with research strategies, and lastly, Susan Harris for all your helpful emails for coordinating this course. And lastly, Pat has one last thing.
You may recall our presentation in August. We had a closing slide. We've now revised it. We have a final cost of this systematic review. It was a predicted cost in August. So 8 credits from 3 different courses for 5 different people, just under $6,000. Transportation to meetings, which actually was cut down because a lot of us are riding bikes, but still, $376.05. Phone calls, cell phones, man, $478.12. Photocopying at $126.56. Printing costs, mostly covered by the CV fees, at $267.89. And our cutting edge filing device, which is $11.02 from Staples. And then, surprise, there was an additional administrative fee due September 5th, $400 times 5 people. But while you can see the costs were great and the burden was high at times, frustration and loss of sleep from thinking about all those results, how we were going to synthesize them, I think everyone will agree that the by filling a chasm in the research base, really, it's completion of a systematic review is priceless. Oh, maybe we do. Oh, no, just references.
Those are all search strategies.
Wrong button.
Do you have a question over here?
Maggie. Hi.
I want to get
I'm just curious. We didn't come across it in our research of literature, but if you found any definition with the eccentric exercise in terms of speed, I know you indicated on a few studies it was 60 degrees per second, but I'm wondering if you know how that might translate into sort of time under tension when you're doing an exercise. Like, maybe from a clinical perspective, if you're doing a squat, how slow should it be, or if you found that?
No, I don't think there is any, definitive. The speeds range a lot. Most of them were, say, between 60 and 100 degrees per second, but they range from 60 all the way to 210. And, from looking at the results, there was no, conclusive evidence that any contraction speed was superior than the other.
I think it comes back to the specificity, depending on what you're training for.
You guys mentioned that because of the decreased oxygen consumption with eccentric exercise, it might be useful in clinical populations like MS and that sort of thing. I was just wondering if you found any research about people who have actually looked at that or anything.
I don't know.
We didn't really look at that because it was part of our exclusion criteria. We excluded any studies that anybody who had pathologies.
Did you come across any that like specifically looked at that that you excluded though, or?
No. There's just primary research that suggests, like on a physiological level, that that occurs. But we didn't come across any studies that actually measure that.
They most likely didn't make it past the citation screening level of ours.
In one of the sections, you said that two of the four studies did not report significance levels. Did you double check the tables and make sure?
Oh yeah.
What triples were those? Not mine, right?
Not yours. No, I'd have to look to see exactly what articles they were, but
that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was quite amazing.
We had similar experiences that the other group described, that there was just a lot of unreported.
Wow. And
data.
Then I'm curious, for the Van Tolder criteria, you guys came up with a different cut point than the tendinosus group. And there is no cut point in the literature. Oh, no?
There is no cut point.
There is no cut point.
We knew, too, and we couldn't find it.
I know, because the reviewers asked us that, too, because sometimes people come up with, well, Pedro has a cut point, right? But mm-hmm. No?
Yeah.
Yeah, Pedro has, what, mild, moderate, and severe? What am I trying to say? high, moderate, and low? They have two cut points? Yeah, okay. But Van Tolder doesn't.
No.
This said to us that as long as we made it clear and as long as we justified our reasons, there is no.
Because reviewers have asked, that's interesting. Okay.
We basically, like it's an 11-point scale, and with this type of study, there are at least a couple of those points that would never get scored with this type of study just because it's too difficult. So we just sort of met as a group, came up with a criteria, and just stuck with it. So we felt that 5 out of 11 was significantly high quality.
And I want to know if the girl that was climbing the rock is also in your class.
No.
She's actually a friend of mine. She graduated from the program, I think, in 2000.
Oh, yeah.
Cyclist?
Sarah.
That's Sarah.
Bob was a skier, too.
Oh, Sarah, who was the skier?
Bob. Yeah.
Oh, Bob.
It was heavy on Bob, that selection.
That was before the program.
Now you're just kind of flabby, right?
Thank you.
Not for the record, Eugene.
Paul. I'd just like to say that conspicuously absent from your presentation were Ryan's enormous quads.
He thought they'd be distracting. He clearly has the biggest quads in the class. I'm not even going to comment on that. There's no way.
Okay, well, I think we